Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. Today's show is hosted by Justin Mendoza and me, Tony Yin. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is about name, image, and likeness, the NIL rules in the NCAA.
This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they're not authorized to provide legal advice. This podcast contains merely general discussion of certain legal and related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer.
So before we start, we'll be talking about the NCAA a lot in today's show, but just to give you a little bit of background information, the NCAA is the National Collegiate Athletic Association. They are a nonprofit organization that regulates student athletes from up to 1,268 North American institutes and conferences. It also organizes athletic programs of colleges and universities in the United States and Canada, and helps over 4,080 college student athletes who compete annually in college sports. Current NCAA rules expressly prohibit college athletes from profiting off their name, image, and likeness, or accepting payment from a third party for the use of the same in any capacity under the long-upheld principle of amateurism.
So, what is amateurism? Amateurism is a term that an athlete must qualify under in order to compete in the NCAA, and it can be violated through methods such as receiving payment for their athletic skills or for use of their name, image, and likeness. The debate over name, image, and likeness rose into prominence with legal cases over workers' compensation. The NCAA was quick to adopt the student-athlete label, and courts soon followed after that, holding that student-athletes were there for emotional, mental, and social benefit. However, notably from this list, economic benefit was missing. The rules have loosened up over time, though. The NCAA has recently allowed college students to compete while pocketing tens of thousands of dollars from the U.S. Olympic Committee if they medal at the Olympics. They can be paid professionals in one sport while competing in a different college sport. Tennis players can receive up to $10,000, while college football players can receive bowl gifts of up to $550. Schools have assistance funds that include paying tens of thousands in insurance for elite athletes that are looking to protect their professional futures. In this, the conferences pay their medical expenses for certain years after they graduate. So, coming back to the definition of amateurism, it seems to be almost ambiguous to a degree. Some have looked at it and seen that clearly some degree of payment is allowed, so they say that it's just ambiguous enough. Under this definition, they're not employees or professionals and subject to those benefits. However, they're also not students and they're subject to their academic constraints under their schools.
The current situation is, in November 2019, NCAA, the Board of Governors, unanimously voted to allow student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness starting in 2021. The NCAA approved legislation for college athletes to receive compensation for NIL-related ventures on October 14th as Division I Council moved for official introduction of the proposed changes into the 2020-2021 legislative cycle. The proposal will allow conditional athlete compensation within set guardrails that include restriction around use of school marks and conflicts of interest. A formal vote comes next in January, but the NCAA is poised to modernize NIL opportunities to some extent. In April 2020, NCAA announced it has accepted recommendation on how best to update its rules on NIL compensation. It released two different categories. First is the third-party endorsement and compensation for student-athlete work product or business activities. And the requirement for this is that it must be genuine and not disguised as participation fee. Schools and conference play no role, and it must have legal right to demand compensation in such a place. This doesn't include group licensing, which would be required for a video game, such as a NCAA football game. As early as July 2021, college athletes will be able to license their NIL for use in commercial products, including sneakers, apparel, sporting equipment, trading cards, and potentially video games, as well as for influencing followers on social media and sponsoring summer camps and autograph drills. Those athletes will be able to hire agents, and the path to this new world of NIL is still under construction as we speak. Specifically, depending on Congress, state legislature, and the NCAA, they all have a say in how the final NIL legislature will look like. While the NCAA works to change its own NIL rules, it has also requested congressional legislation to override the more than 24 state athlete compensation laws recently passed. These individual laws create patchwork policy across the country, with opportunities varying from state to state.
So on a state-to-state basis, the individual states have been passing their own legislation allowing for NCAA student athletes to profit off of their name, image, and likeness. So for example, on September 30th, 2019, the governor of California, Newsom, signed into law the Fair Pay to Play Act, which makes it illegal for California colleges to restrict college athletes from being compensated for use of their NILs. The NCAA then threatened to exclude California members from championship competitions. However, following that, 10 other states, including Colorado, Florida, Kentucky, Nevada, New York, and Pennsylvania, they have all put forth proposals that allow kind of similar ideas to what California did. Florida's bill comes online on July 1st, 2021, and is the first one to do so. It allows more freedoms than what the NCAA proposed in their own policies. As a result, there's pressure on the NCAA because, at that point, why won't every top recruit go to these states where compensation is allowed to a greater degree than the NCAA's policy? They need to put in something overarching that affects each school to the same degree. If they don't, other states with schools in that conference are going to do the exact same thing because they need to keep up. Meanwhile, the NCAA will be lagging behind as a whole. With Congress, they have put forth a bill in early February aiming to remove restrictions to profiting off of their name, image, and likeness. They have had numerous hearings, so it's unknown what its prospect of success is at this point, but it is garnering support. It would make it a federal right that it can't be limited by the NCAA. What they're proposing includes language about a group license for the players, which is big news for fans of the NCAA football game. Currently, as it's looking to make a resurgence, they have yet to receive licensing for the players, only the teams in the game.
Justin, we have a very interesting topic on our hand today. It's something that, you know, as sports fans that we have been hearing, you know, rumors, discussion about for quite a while. And there's definitely arguments on both sides, right?
Yeah.
So, you know what, let me play devil's advocate. Let me just throw an argument at you for why not, right? Why not NIL? So, scholarships are already hefty. 5-year scholarship, it could be worth upwards of $10,000 at just, for example, throw a name out there, Utah State. And you add stipend cash value and grants, the value could go up to $200,000. That's a lot of money. And once we start allowing players to profit off the NIL, will these scholarships be cut off to offset the fundings? And I have to say, for a lot of these schools, a fair amount of their revenue is invested back into the teams. For example, something interesting I just heard is that LSU, they invested in sleeping pods for their football team's locker room. Obviously, there's a discussion about fairness and et cetera, but, you know, what do you think? What do you think? Is there any arguments against this?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an interesting point. But the biggest thing is just the fact that the schools and the NCAA as a whole generate billions of dollars through media deals and other streams of revenue. The coaches themselves, they make millions of dollars. However, the athletes who actually play, they're limited to the costs of attending school. Doesn't that seem wrong? They're the ones who are out there putting the product on the field. So revenue streams are increasing as well as technology progresses. Schools are providing athletes with things such as biometric monitors, and in some cases, they actually own the associated data. There was a deal between, I believe it was the University of Michigan and Nike, where they were using the athletes' data to aid in the development of their products. So it seems that everyone is winning in this case except for the athletes. The pandemic has exacerbated the separation. Athletes are getting a scholarship now, but they're risking their well-being and playing for a school that continues to make millions off them. They can't simply just take the season off for some, as the professional hopes revolve around this year specifically. Yeah, eligibility rules have been extended, but a year of development is still integral for them at this point in their career. They can't afford to sit at home and just go into the gym every day. They need to be playing at full game speed. Additionally, Wisconsin's chancellor, when asked about this, testified that they were not running sports to primarily make money. However, in 2019, they brought in $157 million in revenue. Seems like they're making a pretty good deal of money.
For sure. Compared to that $157 million to maybe the $10,000 we just discussed, that's definitely, you know, peanuts to elephants, right? But yeah. I definitely agree with that. And, you know, overall, amateurism seems to drive a lot of the argument for against NIL. There's an argument that amateurism drives consumer demand for college sports. And, you know, under this logic, paying college athletes for NIL would repel these fans. But, you know, this argument has kind of failed in recent litigations. Even survey data show that consumer doesn't become less interested in college sports if players are paid, particularly for their NIL. Judges have also observed that fans love college sports because of the college spirits, you know, and affinity for their, you know, region and for their school. I think one more argument we can talk about is competitive balance in college sports. But I'll just debunk my own argument right now by saying, you know, this argument can kind of have failed recently as well. Generally, the same top programs remain top programs year after year. And schools, they spend vastly different. You know, they could spend millions on coaches' salaries, stadiums, and training facilities. And it's argued that if NCAA genuinely believed that restricting pay would promote competitive balance, schools would be restricted in these type of spendings. And like you mentioned, legislation definitely play a very important role. As states begin to pass different laws regarding name, image, and likeness, their lack of uniformity will create problems for the NCAA and universities. You know, for example, Florida's law becomes effective in 2021 for NIL 2 years before any other states. This law gives the state of Florida and its universities a huge recruiting advantage. In deciding which school to attend, top athletes will now have to consider the money they can make from their NIL. And this is a, you know, advantage that Florida University just enjoys and any other university will not have. In addition to that, state legislature are incentivized to create more lucrative NIL laws that give their university a huge recruiting advantage. To avoid these, you know, disparities, we need to have some solutions. This is definitely something very interesting, and the Congress plays such an important role, right? Congress needs to pass legislation that creates a uniform NIL laws across the country to ensure a fair and playing field for college athletes.
Yeah, for sure. I think when it comes to competitive balance, it's an interesting argument to make on behalf of the NCAA, because I think it's no secret that when you look to college football, it's a lot of the top teams that remain at the top year after year, and a lot of the small schools don't make it as far consistently. So I think you can say that it promotes competitive balance, but how much competitive balance exists already? How much is paying athletes going to alter this? The big schools are still going to be big schools. On top of that, it seems that the NCAA wants to sort of preserve a space between professional and intercollegiate sports. But there has to be other ways of doing this. It's not simply an issue of salary or compensation. You don't just become a professional athlete because you're getting paid. People will still go and watch the NBA or the NFL instead of watching NCAA games because it's a higher skilled and more well-rounded game. College and amateur sports are watched because they're highly exciting. There's personal connection with the teams, as some of the watchers used to go to those schools. And it's still highly competitive. That's the reason that March Madness draws so many viewers year after year. It's not because the players are or aren't getting paid. You could pay me to start repairing sinks tomorrow, but that wouldn't make me a professional, nor would it make anyone prefer me over an established plumber. So I don't think that argument holds much water.
For Sure. And kind of just adding on to what you're saying, I think there's another argument that, preventing athlete pay helps to integrate academic and athletic goals and thus promote education. But, we have seen so much from recent litigation that even judges, they have a knowledge education is a worthy goal, but has stressed that other non-compensation NCAAs have already advanced this educational goal. For example, NCAA limits the number of weekly hours athletes can spend on athletics and mandate these athletes must attend classes. So, overall, I think these athletes are still getting a great education, but they should be able to get a slice of that pie, right, that universities are getting through their different athletic programs.
For sure, I think that's an incredibly valid concern. I think a lot of people get tunnel visioned on the fact that you're going to go to school, you're going to have your education paid for, you're going to bide your time and then go to professional sports and get paid there. So why not make these students wait 4 years? But I think something that's overlooked is the fact that professional sports aren't an end game for all of these athletes. There are thousands of college athletes who don't get the opportunity to go on and make a living wage playing the game. For some of them, NCAA sports is as high as it goes. By allowing them to profit off their name, image, and likeness, you're allowing them to secure compensation now while they still have earning potential. So, for example, the University of North Carolina was found to have been creating classes that were lacking in substantive content. They were more so just available for student athletes to take to ensure that they maintain their eligibility to play. Does that seem like something that's going to be incredibly useful for them in the future if they don't make it to the NBA or the NFL? Probably not. Students also aren't typically working summer jobs or part-time jobs while they're in school as a student athlete because they're spending so much time in the weight room and on the field and at practice. So they're lacking experience in those respects and income for when they graduate. So they're kind of thrust into the world without too much. Kind of brought up with the UNC point was that some are taking what are called bird courses, or they're just in easy degrees just to be able to say, yeah, I'm going to school, but I'm focusing on football right now. But if they get injured, if they break their leg and they can't go on to professional sports, what does that degree do for them when they realize that they want to practice in a completely different area? So these students are kind of thrust into the real world after, in a life post-sports, with some degrees that might not be as useful and some income that's not going to help them move into their professional lives. So being able to profit off of name, image, and likeness would at least be a step in the right direction for that.
There definitely seem to be a lot of, unregulated area, I guess, currently in NCAA, and these creates rooms for, some shady business maybe here and there, right? So NIL definitely helps to bring some light. But once again, to play devil's advocate, I want to throw another argument at you. This one I feel like is pretty strong, in the sense that NCAA and its members worry that NIL rules continuing restrictions would be vulnerable to antitrust litigations. School and conferences are competing businesses. Should they join hand to restrict how college athletes can utilize NIL, their restrictions could be challenged as price fixing restraint under Section 1 of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The Sherman Antitrust Act was enacted in 1890 to curtail combinations of power that interfere with trade and reduce economic competition. It outlaws both former cartels attempt to monopolize any part of commerce in the United States. And in this case, by having an NIL, it could be argued as monopolizing certain part of the commerce. For instance, a restriction that prevents athletes from endorsing sports betting companies will be subject to challenge, specifically since the NCAA permits schools to sign sponsorship with those same companies. Exemption from the antitrust law would extinguish that concern. But critics have said that antitrust exemptions would be too much, unnecessary, unwise. If the NCAA and its members devise reasonable NIL restrictions, they should not be able to worry about these antitrust litigations. And one case specifically, in NCAA versus Board of Regents, the Supreme Court established that even if the NCAA's amateurism rules are presumed to be competitive, they're not able to be exempt from antitrust scrutiny. Justice Stevens specifically wrote, While as the guardian of an important American tradition, the NCAA's motives must be accorded a respectful presumption of validity. It is nevertheless well established that good motives will not validate an otherwise anti-competitive practice, even under the assumption that NCAA regulations are beneficial to student athletes and are helpful in preserving the model of college sports. NCAA policies cannot automatically be deemed lawful. They must be proven to serve a legitimate pro-competitive purpose. And this sentiment has long been held by different courts. You know, even in O'Bannon versus NCAA, Judges Bybee of the Ninth Circuit echo kind of what Justice Stephen was saying. Justice Bybee specifically wrote, although we agree with the Supreme Court and our sister circuit that many of NCAA's amateurism rules are likely to be pro-competitive, we hold that those rules are not exempt from antitrust scrutiny. Rather, they must be analyzed. And the majority panel reaffirmed that NCAA regulations are subject to antitrust scrutiny and must be tested in the crucible of the rule of reason. So, you know, I guess I kind of debunked my own argument by saying all that, but I guess on the stress, NCAA, I guess, even with NIL, is not above antitrust laws. And court cannot and must not shy away from requiring the NCAA to play by the Sherman Act's rules. So, you know, this has been asserted and reasserted again and again. And I believe it's an important consideration in the sense that, you know, how do we protect these universities? But also, how do we not overprotect them where we make them above the law, right? So that's definitely something very interesting.
Yeah, I think the antitrust exemption is something that's been brought up by the NCAA, but it's an incredibly dangerous and powerful thing to have because the NCAA would have unbounded power to restrain athletes' fair market rights without facing any legal repercussions. As Judge Smith wrote in his concurring opinion in National Collegiate Athletic Association Athletic Grant and Aid Cap Antitrust Litigation, the treatment of student athletes is not the result of free market competition. To the contrary, it is the result of a cartel of buyers acting in concert to artificially depress the price that sellers could otherwise receive for their services. Our antitrust laws were originally meant to prohibit this exact sort of distortion. So to the extent that state name, image, and likeness statutes then clash with pending name, image, and likeness rules, with this exemption, the NCAA could insist that those statutes unreasonably interfere with interstate commerce. States are generally forbidden from enacting statutes that unduly impact the economies of other states. So the NCAA could argue that a state statute, which imposes a different set of name, image, and likeness rules for schools and athletes than those prescribed by national NCAA rules, would lead to conflict and disruption within the college sports industry. In the NCAA v. Miller, the NCAA successfully invoked an interstate commerce argument in defeating requirements adopted by the state of Nevada for athletic disciplinary hearings. Those requirements conflicted with NCAA rules. As to conflict with a possible federal name, image, and likeness statute, the language of a state statute would be key. The Student Athlete Level Playing Field Act, for example, would preempt states from enforcing their own name, image, and likeness statutes. The NCAA would prefer preemption to be part of any federal name, image, and likeness law. The power of the federal government to preempt states, however, is a complicated legal topic, as evidenced in the multi-year effort to overturn federal ban on state sports betting, and it could attract litigation at that point. Something that people have kind of discussed this as is, with recruiting and inducements, there's two sorts of periods. There's pre-recruiting and post-recruiting. Pre-recruitment is everything that happens when you're trying to get the athlete to come to your school. So that's, we'll pay you this to come to play at Alabama, for example. Post-recruitment is when they're actually playing for the school. Are they able to sell playing cards with their picture on it and make money off of that? So that's kind of the dichotomy. However, with the rules that have been made prohibiting inducements, whether or not the player is at the school or not, there's a kind of a gray area that I've seen here because let's say somewhere like Clemson, where they've had a guy like Trevor Lawrence, obviously the big businesses there and the owners are going to want to leverage that for their brand. So they're going to be throwing money at Trevor Lawrence to come out and put his face on their walls. and back their products. So now the next five-star quarterback recruit that's coming out of high school sees that. He sees all this money that Trevor Lawrence has made because he's been allowed to under these new regulations. And he wants to join Clemson because of the big stage that it puts him on for endorsements from boosters and other corporate parties. So at that point, is that going to be viewed as a recruiting inducement because it's inducing him to come to Clemson? Or is that just a happy coincidence that will be allowed under the rules? So I guess my question is, what point does it become a wrongful inducement as just a factor of bringing in that much revenue for the player?
Sure. I mean, NIL is still something to be finalized with all the legislatures and Congress involvement. And there's definitely many, many questions moving forward, right? Even if we think about, you know, pro athletes as employees or et cetera, how do we really perceive them, you know? Can we allow them to form unions then, which in turn, you know, certify and regulate agents that these athletes could hire? Right now, that just isn't an option for college athletes. Under the current interpretation of the law, college athletes aren't employees and thus can't unionize. The NCAA's ability to certify and oversee agents is also questionable. So if it isn't a labor organization, then it lacks the legal authority of one. So the NCAA also isn't an arm of a state government, such as a board of registration for real estate brokers. The NCAA technically isn't statutorily empowered to license the agents. So the federal NIL proposal have suggested that Federal Trade Commission or an independent commission take on these roles, but there are just so much uncertainty with any of these ideas. So unless college athletes can establish under the law they are employees of their school, they can't really unionize under the labor law because only employees can unionize. So far, NCAA has been resistant to an alternative vehicle for college athletes to join hands. You know, for example, they propose group licensing. Athletes could form, let's say, a trade association along the lines discussed over the summer by, you know, Trevor Lawrence, like you mentioned, and other star players. These trade associations can function in some ways as a union, but don't require the employee recognition. A trade association will license college players' likeness for inclusion in video games as well. And one last thing I think is very interesting that maybe we can leave to the listeners is, you know, whether alcohol, tobacco, and sports gambling should be precluded. You know, whether athletic shoe apparel companies should be excluded or have limited participation in this newly permitted field. You know, this is due to their history of encouraging or facilitating recruiting and other rules infractions. And there are just so many more questions, right, that needs to be answered. And I think it's been a very interesting discussion. And once again, we just want to stress that these are just things we found through our research. We're definitely not lawyers and we're definitely not putting forward any legal advice. So Trevor Lawrence, if you're listening, no legal advice for you.
Before we end the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. Once again, to reiterate, the Pro Bono Radio team are not lawyers, and this episode does not contain legal advice. Today's show is produced by Justin Mendonza and Tony Yin. We are your hosts, and if you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website. Thank you for listening.